I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Alva.
And I'm Stephen.
And you're listening to the New Statesman podcast. On today's episode, we talk about the UK's coronavirus response, and you ask us, why isn't Keir Starmer aligned with the teaching unions on schools closing? So we're back after our break for Christmas. Anoush is still on holiday. Stephen, we have a lot to catch up on since we last spoke. We are recording on Monday afternoon, and we're currently in a situation where senior Conservatives, including Jeremy Hunt, are calling on Boris Johnson to introduce a full national lockdown. And it is looking increasingly likely that that is going to happen, maybe even potentially later today. We might see some sort of announcement, not least because Boris Johnson himself said this morning that tougher restrictions are inevitable. If it isn't too grand a question, Stephen, where would you say we are in terms of our coronavirus response? And what do you think are the big problems that have led us here?
Well, I think in some ways, the problem is there is no such thing as the UK's coronavirus response. Not just in a kind of, and I'm sure we'll get onto the like England, Scotland, Wales element further on in the episode, but there's the government's sort of revealed policy choice, which is basically like what is the kind of like between like Boris Johnson's unwillingness slash inability to do any of the like executive stuff where you go, I am prioritizing X. So to take a obviously current example, let's say that you did actually want to prioritize schools staying open. Well, that would have huge implications for what you would ask to keep locked earlier in the pandemic. Whereas instead, what actually happened is us prioritizing schools staying open is just that we have never really planned full closures, right? Like we haven't gone, oh, how could we improve digital learning? Yeah, what stuff could we do so we actually have meaningful distance learning rather than just a bunch of exhausted teachers? We haven't done any of that kind of stuff. But we also haven't done any of the, okay, well, if we really want schools to stay open, then no, sorry, you can't get a haircut in tier three. You can't get a takeaway. Yeah, like we haven't done any of those kind of risk minimization stuff earlier on. And now, of course, we're back at the point where you can't really do any of those things. So there's the stuff which results from the kind of inability to prioritize. Then there's the stuff which results from the kind of inability to decide between the kind of Michael Gove, Matt Hancock position of lockdown, scientific developments will save us, and the kind of Rishi Sunak majority of the cabinet position of the debt, if yeah, we've got to learn to live with it. You put all of those kind of things together, and the end result is the government policy, which is basically to have as few restrictions as you can get away with until the point when the NHS starts to cry uncle. And then, of course, you end up having much deeper restrictions. And I think that's basically been the story of everything we have done since the end of the first lockdown.
The thought that has been plaguing me over the holidays, which I think I'm going to write up just so that I don't have to keep thinking it, is that exactly as you say, the reason for locking down in March and the reasons that we currently have very tough restrictions and that we're probably going to have to introduce even tougher ones in the days to come is to avoid the NHS being over capacity. And I feel like we say that a lot, you know, the danger of the NHS being overwhelmed. But I feel like perhaps in some parts of the media and sometimes when that's being discussed, I feel like it's slightly misunderstood. I heard a commentator the other day talking about how we were bending the economy out of shape to throw a human shield around the NHS, which I think is basically a correct assessment of what we're doing at the moment. But I felt a little bit like that is describing the NHS as sort of an abstract concept or as an ideal or a very British value about an institution, rather than what it really means, which is that we've had this discussion, particularly in the UK, more so than I think in many other parts of the world. We've had this discussion for a lot of 2020. We were talking endlessly about the sort of the question of how much we live with the virus and how much we let it rip through society and getting the balance right between the economy and health restrictions. And I think that some parts of the Conservative parliamentary party that have these big ideological objections to lockdown and parts of the media that have a big ideological problem with these restrictions on the economy and people's freedoms, I think that those parts of the public debate maybe weren't really thinking about the way that there has always been a completely like non-negotiable upper limit on how much COVID we can have as a society, which isn't going to be set by a sort of implicit or explicit decision on the part of government about how many deaths we're happy to have as a result of this pandemic. But it's just set by the very real limit of the NHS's capacity. Because if the NHS is overwhelmed, you are looking at a situation in which someone has a heart attack and there is just no room for them in hospital because it is full of COVID patients, but where people are denied treatment for a huge range of health problems because of the pandemic. And that, I mean, that would be a literal case of state failure. And I think when we have these discussions about how much we want the NHS, that sort of balance between the economy and health and the restrictions that we can live with and so on, I think that we haven't really taken that upper bound into account. Like, no one has sort of actually had the debate about whether we're happy to be a failed state and just like not have the health service able to meet the needs of the population. And so I think, as you say, we're in this kind of strange situation where, rather than sort of thinking, well, if we want the economy to be opened up, or we're aware of all the dangers and harms, economic and human, of lockdown, so rather than thinking we don't want a lockdown, so we're going to open everything up, you have to have the public health measures in place to allow that opening up. You can't just sort of will it to be a certain way, because you just end up locking down again, which is exactly what we're seeing. We've just seen these cycles of lockdown and release. I feel a little bit exhausted because I feel like we could have avoided a lot of the discussion around the value or otherwise of restrictions and living with the virus if we had been really thinking about the ways in which we actually set up our society and our virus response to allow ourselves to live without restrictions, rather than just like, you know, going for lower restrictions first, knowing that eventually we were going to have to lock down again. We spent a lot of last year talking about restrictions and living with the virus as though we had a choice, when there was ultimately at the upper end of COVID cases, we don't really have a choice. You're going to have to lock down to prevent the health service being overwhelmed. And that isn't some sort of vague ideal about the NHS being a great British value, but it's just sort of about the provisions that the state is committed to delivering for people.
Yeah, no, I think that's exactly right. And I think one of the things I found, I mean, there are many things that are frustrating about the state of British corona policy, because it feels like it's entered, you know, that stage during the Brexit debate where you could sit there being like, oh, and now he's going to call on Hillary Benn, and that means he's going to go, okay, after he's gone to Hillary Benn, he will either have gone to Yvette Cooper before Hillary Benn, or he'll go to her straight afterwards. Okay, well, now he's going to switch over, oh, so Bernard Jenkin gets a go. It's essentially exactly like that again, except it's like, we do this thing, you know, that we understand has a direct and very obvious cost in terms of rising caseloads. The rising caseloads do their thing. Then at about the point where, like, the public has started to get antsy, Keir Starmer goes, it's time for action. Then about a day after Keir Starmer has gone, oh, the public has got to a position where it's safe for me to say it's time for non-specified action, Boris Johnson is like, I think it's time for us to consider maybe having some proposals about maybe having some action in a couple of days' time. And then, like, someone leaks to a friendly newspaper, then at some point in the next couple of days, then you know, maybe, you know, some part of the of British society will close down. It's just, A, how, like, inevitable and sort of boring it is. It's not only we have, like, a lockdown where one's not allowed to do anything oneself, but in which politics is stuck in this kind of, like, oh, maybe I'll go for a walk to the big park today. But, you know, with a horrendous toll. But also exactly as you say, right? Now, obviously, it is true to say that the NHS has an emotional presence in British political debates that most other free-at-the-point-of-use healthcare systems do not have. But the political challenge, right? Like, just because, like, no one in Israel goes, oh, you know, I'm really invested in my health fund, it means the world to me, doesn't change the fact. And the reason why they ended up having to go, why they ended up going to lockdown, is because eventually, right, you turn up and it doesn't matter that you have an entitlement to free point of use healthcare through your insurance plan, right? You ain't going to get to keep it, right? Because the hospital's overwhelmed. Like, ditto, like, no one in France has a, like, emotional connection to their free at the point of use healthcare insurance model. But the reason why they have to do this is because eventually healthcare capacity collapses. I think one of the things I found, like, particularly frustrating, and obviously it's also the fact, you know, like, it's lockdown and it's dark, so everything is also just a bit more, is the complete lack of quite important scientific understanding amongst, like, the political class. The central issue being with the kind of, and I mean, one, so we have a vaccine, yet there are still some people saying, oh, maybe we should just learn to live with it. But also, all viruses mutate, right? That's, you know, that is why it's always in your interest, if you have the ability to pursue an elimination strategy, both, you know, if you're a country which hasn't had it yet, or if you've developed, yeah, this is why, and I think it's the thing people don't really understand about the Oxford vaccine, right? In the, so the reason why in South Africa there's now this variant that may have come here already that may delay the end of lockdown, because it may require the vaccines to go back into development for 6 weeks or so, is the broadly, most African democracies, and indeed most African countries, full stop, have realized that because they have a younger population, the social, economic, and kind of mental health costs of lockdown do not have the same sort of spur, because healthcare infrastructure is going to be fine. The problem is that the more cases you have circulating, right, it's not guaranteed that the coronavirus continues to only affect the old and the vulnerable. Also, I think anyone who talks about it is only affecting the vulnerable should be challenged to list exactly what the conditions that make you vulnerable are. Because trust me, the impression that those people both convey and I suspect have about what it means to be vulnerable in a coronavirus context is not, yeah, it's not one that would recognize, most people would recognize. And indeed, it includes a number of symptoms. And the first discovery you may have and you have it is when you die of the coronavirus. And I think in general, one of the problems is that we've had very poor scientific understanding of the issues among the political class. As a result, we've had a very poor public debate, very poor public information, both led by our politicians directly, but also by our national broadcaster, which is why you've had, like, all sorts of disasters, like people having a meal outside and the restaurant has put them in a little tent with a heater. And it's just like, I understand why you've done this, but this essentially means you get rid of any of the benefits of just doing this out in person. Like, why have you done this? I suspect, because the thing we haven't really touched on ever, right, is that although the UK has had, I think, the worst overall coronavirus response among developed economies, barring Sweden, yeah, so of the ones which have kind of, you could say, have tried, it's also situated in the part of the world. Yeah, if you were to have an argument about, well, who's dealt with this the worst, right? The contenders, other than the United States, which I don't think counts for the same reason I don't think Sweden counts, because I don't think then those countries can broadly be said to have tried. Their policy response has just been flawed for another reason. But the countries where you can be like, well, you get a merit badge, are all countries of our type in Western Europe. And I suspect that one of the reasons for that is just a poor scientific understanding among our political elites. I include the media in that. And so I think that's why your kind of point about the NHS and why actually it isn't a choice you get to make, it's just something you can choose when it happens, is exactly right.
On a slightly different note, Stephen, you mentioned that we would probably go on to thinking about the sort of the four nations and how they're all doing. I'm, of course, coming to you live from, well, not live, just live for you, not for anyone else, from Belfast still. And Northern Ireland is going to be in basically lockdown until the beginning of February. Wales is in a lockdown at the moment. Scotland is basically already in a lockdown with plans to toughen up the stay-at-home message today. And England is the only one that isn't completely, in that tier four is tantamount to a lockdown, even though anecdotally there's a lot of talk about actually the freedoms that people are still enjoying in tier four, in terms of still like lots of people being spotted on the streets and being out and about in London and so on. But there's still tier three, which does leave other things open in other parts of England. But the thing that strikes me, actually, we've been talking about really about Boris Johnson and his government, which is, for all the reasons we've just talked about, really like is not covering itself in glory in its response to this. But I think the interesting thing is that things are looking like very bad in the places that are already locked down. At the moment, in terms of cases per 100,000, Northern Ireland actually has the worst case rate of the four nations at the moment. It's really shot up over the past few weeks. And I think that's the first time that that has happened, which obviously means in terms of raw numbers, Northern Ireland is still looks very low. But it does show that across the four nations and their different approaches, a lot has gone wrong since December. We're just starting to see the impact of the Christmas debacle and the easing of restrictions and the last minute U-turns over that. But I suppose the thing that just really strikes me is that there are at least quite tough restrictions in Northern Ireland and in Scotland and Wales already, whereas I think the risk is that in England, the tiered system, as we see these cases going up and the death toll going up, we can at least expect that with these quite like high levels of restrictions in the other parts of the UK, that in 2 weeks' time, we should see those coming down, that like this should be the peak roughly. But that isn't necessarily a guarantee in England, where there is a higher tier for a lot of England to go into. That's just the striking team thing, that at the moment, they're kind of all united in terms of how bleak the picture is, with things particularly bad in London and the southeast. But I think it's the risk that England stays in a bad situation for longer because of its tiered approach that I think would be most concerning.
So the interesting thing is, it's throughout this crisis that like the central political victory of Nicola Sturgeon has been setting out a different approach in terms of style rather than in terms of function. Although I would add that I think one of the things people slightly fail to understand about a public health crisis is actually style is quite an important difference. Having lucid communication is an important difference in a public health crisis, right? I mean, to use a non-contemporary example, many of the advice, then, you know, if you had, okay, I was asked if you'd Googled, obviously there was no gov.uk in the 1980s. If you had gone to your local library and dug out like the government advice in many democracies, you would have got something quite similar to the public health messaging that came literally from, you know, the mouth of the Prime Minister and the Health Secretary, partly through the Health Secretary, Norman Fowler, going, look, no, I'm afraid you do have to use these very specific words, otherwise this won't work. Communication in a public health crisis is an important difference, even if the policies are broadly the same. Actually, the thing about the kind of Christmas debacle is it did produce for the first time genuinely large divergence in terms of approach between Scotland and England, in that the caseload is considerably higher in England, but Scotland not only had an even more curtailed version of the Christmas provision, but has gone immediately into another lockdown with a lower caseload than at any other point than it would. So broadly, the average person in Scotland is in tier four. And if that person, with the same healthcare capacity, same level of cases in their area were in England, they would be in tier three or tier two. So that is quite a big and important difference for the first time. But as you say, the kind of central question for all parts of the United Kingdom is that the thing which makes lockdown a deliverable policy approach are all about levers that the Treasury can or cannot choose to pull. all of which currently expire in April. Now, it may be that the vaccine rollout does achieve exponential growth. The initial hiccups, kind of a thing of the past. And in a couple of weeks, everything that's usually used as a polling station is being used as a vaccination center. And the number of vaccinations has gone through the roof. But there are two lingering problems for the devolved governments. One, that they do now both have genuinely stricter approaches. Can you maintain consent for that if, there's this large landmass right next to you, which isn't doing that? One of the distinct challenges in Wales is that not all of the hubs of economic activity in Wales are actually in Wales, right? So in Scotland and in England, right, the major geographic clusters are centred around cities that are actually in those nations, right? But in addition, of course, to the vitally important role that Cardiff and Swansea play in the Welsh economy, to a lesser but still important extent, Liverpool and Chester play an important role in the Welsh economy. And it's therefore much harder to see how you can have a meaningful, enduring, long-term lockdown if we still have a situation in which Liverpool, Chester and the rest of the United Kingdom are shuttling in and out of different tiers. I do kind of think, however, that probably, well, at no point in this crisis has anyone gone bust betting that the government in England will reach the same decision point as the devolved governments and, the government in France, 5 days later. And I think that will be the case here as well, right? We'll have the ridiculous from a public health perspective decision that large numbers of schools in England will have been told to go back for 5 days just to make sure they've spread the disease as far as they could. They'll then be told they need to close. This will obviously have an effect in terms of the number of coronavirus cases in the United Kingdom and in England, well, also in the United Kingdom, have implications for how long England has to remain locked down. But from a political perspective, more importantly, just further adds to the biggest boon that the SNP has managed to take from this crisis, which is Nicola Sturgeon having had a better crisis than Boris Johnson. Mm-hmm. And I think that's kind of the most important political consequence of all of this.
If you've been enjoying our podcast and want to find out more about what we think and some of our colleagues too, then why not subscribe to The New Statesman? You can get 12 weeks for £12. Go to newstatesman.com/subscribe12.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
And now it's time for a section we like to call
You Ask Us.
Today's question, picking up on a similar theme to the first section, but specifically on schools reopening. We've had a lot of questions on this theme, but this one has been put very pithily. So it's, why won't the Labour Party support organised labour? How has Keir Starmer been outflanked in terms of supporting teachers' right to work in safe conditions by Tony Blair, the Lib Dems and 67% of the British public? So, Stephen, how do you explain the Labour Party's position on schools remaining closed? So far, they've sort of been broadly siding with the government, saying that they should stay open. How do you explain the apparent caution on this one and the apparent divergence from what teaching unions are calling for?
The caution is the easiest part of their what I view as their mistakes in how they've approached this, is the easiest bit to understand, which can basically be answered through, like, have you spoken to a parent with school-aged children over the past year? Broadly, the level of rage, concern, sort of ambient thing at the prospect of school closures for a large chunk of that period, for a prospect of them remaining closed when they were closed for a large chunk of that period, the idea of them being closed, right? So that's kind of the push factor all along, has been that parental anger. And actually, from an electoral politics perspective, and also from the fact that, right, school closures do have huge social costs, I think that their kind of rhetorical position initially of no ifs, no buts, schools should not close, was the correct one, electorally, morally, from policy terms. The problem was, is that, and this is why I actually think in some ways, right, I would say the big problem is, I suspect that both our questioner and Keir Starmer do see this question in the same way, which is like, oh, there's this thing called the teachers' unions, and you need to triangulate in and around their position and the government's position, and then doing this somehow finds you victory. Actually, I'm sorry, I think the teachers' union position, A, has been reasonable throughout, but actually is kind of irrelevant, because let's imagine for a moment then the teaching union's position, and obviously we're talking about unions with quite different internal politics, quite different area interests, so the relative level of unity there is a sign, I would argue, that the government has messed it up. But let's for a moment imagine that the teaching unions are incorrect, or that they are solely concerned about the interests of their members. Well, one, that's kind of their job. That is their role in the political system. But that still wouldn't change the fact that school closures are a policy with huge costs. And then the way, if you want to accomplish that, you have to be willing to be more radical and more bullish on calling for closures elsewhere than the Labour Party has ever really been willing to be. And you know, some people will, I know, because whenever I've made this point in like the email or if I alluded to it in the podcast, you know, many, many people emailed me, like, he called for a 2-week circuit breaker to coincide with half term. Okay, that's true. But look, the circuit breaker can delay the peak for 2 weeks, but it can't in of itself fix the scale of the problem, right? Unless, you know, now what would fix the problem would be if you went, we're actually going to circuit break during every single school break, right? You say, look, actually, I'm afraid that does mean a more miserable summer for some people. I'm afraid that doesn't mean X, Y, Z, right? Like, there are, you know, there are lots of things you could do that would sort of meet that position. And I just think that the problem is they've entered this zone of, oh, you know, we have our Labour Party stakeholders, we have our stakeholders in this thing, and then parents are really angry. Instead of just being like, okay, right, if the policy outcome you want is schools to remain open, that has large but actually quite obvious implications for your what you will and won't unlock. And I think this is the thing is that, like, surprise, surprise, I think Tony Blair is a more effective politician than Keir Starmer. But yeah, like, I think one of the reasons why, for example, Blair has like ended up in has had a better and more cogent position is that he does understand that you have to prioritize what it is, the thing that you want, and act accordingly. And if what you want is to avoid school closures, that has implications for what else you do. And at this point, right, like this because of the failure to prioritize, right, the scientific decision makes itself. So you now just do end up in a position where you're like, well, yeah, of course they need to close, because you didn't do any of the other things than they've done. The problem is, because Keir Starmer did not go, we want schools to stay open and therefore XYZ has to close, they can't retreat to, well, you didn't do any of the things we asked you to do to keep schools open, so now schools have to close. They have to then be like, I know we said that it was important to keep them open, but now it's important for them to close, and we can't really point to anything we would have done differently. Now, you can podcast past him, say, yeah, well, look, if like there had been more of a focus on their sick pay policy, they'd have a better story to tell on that, but there wasn't, so they don't. I think, yeah, to be honest, to annoy our Lib Dem listeners even more than usual, I think, you know, with the Lib Dems, right, like, for them it is just a lot easier. They're a much smaller party, and they haven't had to be particularly coherent on this. But also, the thing that they have done well is they have had a consistent line of broadly being like, well, we're not going to be outflanked by Sage, which means that in August they had the correct, even though no one wrote about it because, you know, who cares about the Lib Dems, correct position of, well, schools being open is a policy with costs, so you can't open other things if you want to do it. And now they have the correct, well, you didn't do that, so schools got to close. Yeah, so I think broadly the problem is just a lack of sort of, not so much strategic thinking, but a lack of kind of a willingness to go, we want this thing and therefore we will not have that thing. And if you don't do that, whether it's in government or in opposition, eventually you end up in a bit of a mess. So yeah, what do you think's gone wrong?
Just thinking about your point on the Lib Dems, I really do think that there's the trail of a coherent coronavirus response in the neglected Lib Dem press office press releases in my inbox, that I think you are right that because the stakes aren't as high for them, they have been able to have, I think, quite a coherent response and have been a lot bolder in the things that they call for quite consistently since the summer or even before. Whereas, as you say, I mean, there have been points like with the circuit breaker where Keir Starmer did stick his head above the parapet. But in general, I mean, thinking about the Christmas policy, I do remember the press release from Labour when the four nations unveiled their plans for Christmas, which I think you could tell a mile off were a disaster. And, the, you know, the Labour Party was calling for an urgent plan to make sure that the trains would run properly. And then, you know, yesterday we saw that big intervention from Keir Starmer calling for a national lockdown, which arguably is what was required. But somewhat ironically, given that they mentioned zoos being one of the things that are open in tier four that they would like to close, the intervention completely ignored the elephant in the room, which is that cases are now so high that schools will inevitably have to close. I just agree with you. I was interested to hear your perspective on it. I think that it just seems to me that since this is a decision that the government is inevitably going to have to take and quite soon, the Labour Party can't be bothered with the political cost of being the ones who disappoint parents or seen to disappoint parents by saying, oh, you have to close schools, with all the disruption that that will cause, all of the known harms of taking children out of school. And kind of, as you say, you turning on your position of schools having to stay open without being able to point to very many policy interventions where you've shown how you would keep schools open. But I found the announcement yesterday quite bizarre for that reason. I think that the Labour Party just occasionally in recent months has had a real habit of intervening to call for something big and urgent, but it's actually quite a small intervention. And I think that Keir Starmer making his intervention on a Sunday but not addressing the schools thing was a bit of a failure. And also, I'm not actually sure there would be that many political costs of stating the obvious at this point, that schools need to close or at least be delayed, and that should be not just in London and places where the incidence of the new variant is very high, but across England.
Like, so the thing I know I don't know is, instinctively, I just think that, I promise I'm going to cut down on these a bit in 21, but I am going to do an Arsenal metaphor here, right? Which is that when Mikel Arteta became Arsenal coach, right, the thing that he improved was that the team became much tougher to beat, right? And it did better at, like, big games. But the second that the team had to be protagonists, right, when we were playing, you know, Burnley at home, to pick a real-world example, the team just lacked any forward momentum, lacked any gumption, lacked any plan to win games. And in some ways, the big strategic victory of 2020 that Keir Starmer has is that he did not, in the early period of like March, when anyone who went, maybe we should be locking down fast, became, you know, a kind of subject of like a, you know, 2-minute hate, did not introduce himself to the public in an unfavourable way. The problem is that, can you win an election with a kind of safety first? We're just not going to get done on the counter. And at some point, like, we'll just nick a goal somehow, right? Can you win an election doing that? I have this problem where all of the available data suggests to me, yes, you can, but I just don't believe it. I just think at some point something goes wrong, right? Yeah, whether the Conservatives get rid of Boris or the Labour Party never gets into the position it needs to be on economic competence. But, you know, something means that it doesn't work out, right? And I think we're starting to see some of the ways that something doesn't begin to work out, which is that if you're not willing to take the risk in Christmas, because as you say, with the Christmas press release, it was obvious that everyone connected in the Labour Party thought privately this was a terrible idea. It's just like, if you're not willing to like take the risk of going, yes, I am the person who thinks that you should count. Yeah. If you're not willing to be the person who go like, I know it's hard, I know it's upsetting, but Christmas this year will be me, Vix, and the kids. If you're not willing to have that little bit of risk-taking, so if you're not willing to be like, school should stay open, and that's why I'm not getting a Just Eat, right? Like, if you're not willing to do that kind of small, but actually risky stuff, you're only willing to do the, like, now public opinion and the health data is doing what it's doing, and now I'm going to enter the debate. I just think that eventually it doesn't work. Eventually you do lose to Burnley at home. But yeah, I promise I'm only going to do this once every month. So there will only be 12 Arsenal analogies this year.
That's your New Year's resolution.
Yeah.
You've been listening to the New Statesman podcast with me, Alva Ray, and you can find me on Twitter at pronounced Alva, A-L-V-A.
And you can find me on Twitter at Stephen KB.
We're produced by Nick Hilton, and our music is Devil with the Devil, licensed under Creative Commons. Thanks for listening.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, Freddie here. I want to tell you about a new way you can support the New Statesman's independent journalism. Every morning I send out Morning Call, our daily newsletter covering everything you need to know about British politics. It's free to sign up, plus for just £3 a month, you'll get a recommended daily piece of ours sent to you in full, plus exclusive polling analysis from Ben Walker, a weekly update from Will Dunn, and our featured piece on Sundays. If you enjoy this podcast, you'll love Morning Call. Head to morningcall.substack.com and subscribe now.